Hey everyone, welcome to
We Rebel.
Nick's not here this week. Just kidding.
I'm here.
He's here in spirit, but
so disappointed in what just happened.
Disappointed. It's better than horns.
It's not better than horns. It's better than horns. All right, let's get into it.
Yes.
This was a crazy week.
It was, as per usual, we're back with
a crazy week. I'm actually my hangover is pretty much gone. So
Hangover.
Maybe I am hungover.
So maybe you're still there. But Nick's birthday is in, well, if this episode's
two
out
days.
On Monday,
it'll be
the next day, so on Tuesday.
But we had a birthday party last night that we alluded to. No, We Rebellers were there, and we invited you guys, so.
So
still unsure if they know who we are
in real life,
but that's okay. It's totally fine.
I'm unclear as to why she didn't book a flight to come to your birthday party.
Yeah, balls in your court, fans.
But truly, from the bottom of my heart, the happiest of birthdays to both of you.
Thank you, Emily.
Thank you.
So
thank
sweet.
You for being part of the rebellion.
Aww. Okay, but on serious notes, let's get on to the news. Because obviously, we're still coming off of the tales of
Charlottesville.
So everyone knows right now. So there was a Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia on Saturday. Members of essentially the Nazi party.
Let's say what it is.
Yeah.
Let's not say alt-right anymore. Yeah. They're Nazis.
They're Nazis.
Yeah, they're Nazis.
And so they decided they want to march, and they have their swastikas, they have their signs, they're spreading their messages of hate. Of course, like any situation like this, you're going to have counter protesters who are, you know, standing up for it. No, equality is right. So we all know what happens. Then one man decides to drive his car into,
one coward.
He drives his car into the crowd, killing one woman, injuring 19.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
Her name was Heather Heyer. So mm-hmm.
Unbelievable.
Let's not forget that. I'm looking at Sean King's Twitter account right now. And I think it says here, the last words on her Facebook said, "If you're not outraged, you're not paying attention." So rest in peace to Heather Heyer, because it's tragic that she lost her lives at the hands of a coward. We're not going to say the name of because he
doesn't deserve it. Yeah. So obviously the world then waits for what Donald Trump is going to say. So on Saturday from his golf course, he says, quote, "The hate and division must stop and must stop right now. We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry and violence on many sides. On many sides. It's been going on for a long time in our country." So it's not many sides.
No,
it's not many sides. I don't care what kind of spin you want to put on this. There was a man full of hate, a coward full of hate, who decided that he was going to hurt someone. If you watch the videos, there was no sign of him putting his brakes on. In fact, I think if there wasn't a car in front of him, he would not have stopped.
Well, I think too, you know, this on many sides thing is so problematic because people are like, oh, well, there was violence from the anti-white nationalist protesters. One, I really haven't seen anything about that. And two, if you are protesting, I think there's like this mix up where people think that a right to free speech means that you can say whatever you want without consequence. And that's not the case. You can say whatever you want in this country, but you can also be fired from your job for saying it. And you can elicit reactions from people. And when you are saying, you know, death to certain people, certain races or religions or sexuality, genders, there's going to be a reaction to that. And if you want to defend the side that said that and came out and has preached nothing but violence, it's, you know, your pictures are going to be in the history books, and it's shameful. It's truly shameful. If you still support this administration, if you support that man, it's shameful.
And I watched as a lot of Republicans came out, and you know they were reacting to Trump's statements.
Marco Rubio found a spine,
and everyone's, you know, all of a sudden coming
out, saying something.
But here's my caveat to that. Great, awesome that you want to stand up to Trump and not look like the racist in the room. However, Trump has played this card since he was running his campaign.
Mm-hmm.
We knew how he was going to react to something like this, and you agreed to it. when you endorsed him, when you let him become the figure of your party, you said, okay, he talks poorly about women, minorities, but you know, let's let it slide. So you agreed to this. And so if you're for you to say like, oh no, like, you know, that this is wrong, we don't agree with it. No, you do, because he's in office right now because of you, because you agreed with
right.
this.
Yeah. He was, you know, he's saying, oh, you know, beat that guy up. I hope they knock that guy in the face.
Yep.
All of this stuff has been, yeah, James is absolutely right. It's day one. It is day one stuff that he said. He has encouraged violence. The only people that he hasn't criticized are white supremacists and Vladimir Putin. Yeah. It's absurd. If you still support this man, shame on you. Mm-hmm. Truly, shame on you. That can come from just me or everyone. I don't know. But it's ridiculous. This is bad, and we're really divided and fractured as a country right now. But I want to be very clear to anyone that's listening. There are more of us. There are more progressives. There are more liberals. I saw something on Twitter. Someone said the reason they're acting, I think it was DeRay McKesson, said the reason that they're acting this way is because they are scared. And we're taking down their monuments, and we are marching forward, and they are scared, and they are lashing out because they are cowards. So, we took down Nazis once. We're going to go 2 for 2.
Yep.
All
right. So, on that note, let's go to our next big topic.
Yeah, what happened this week?
Yes.
Oh,
this feels like it was so long ago, but we're finally talking about North Korea.
It does feel like it was so long ago. Yeah, North Korea. Our topic title, authored by the incredible Nick, is all caps. All right, fine. I guess we got to cover North Korea now too.
It's so sad.
I'm feeling very sad right now.
Do you want just like a quick overview of because North Korea has ramped up their nuclear capability, and which has really taken off at an incredible rate since Trump took office. And then Donald Trump, said, North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen. And that was improvised. Are you kidding me?
It's like anyone that watches It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, it's Charlie Kelly doing the wild card.
Yeah.
The wild card, bitches, snap the brakes off.
Yeah. And it's funny when it's on a TV show, but when you're...
This is reality.
It's real life, motherfucker.
Yeah,
this is reality. I think it's, we talk about this every episode, but it is another example of unbelievable amounts of chaos and miscommunication within allegedly a administration. Like, I'm hesitant when we say Trump administrations, like, they're not doing any. There is no administration because no one's working. No one's communicating with each other. There are no systems in place. And this is another example of, say, they were like, we knew he's going to deliver a tough message, but didn't expect a threat. And it's like, that is a severe difference. That's not just like, oh, we didn't know he was going to mention, you know, a part of our nuclear energy plan or a part of like where we stand on the issue. It's like, no, it's the difference between a message and a threat, which literally is the difference between like peace and war.
Yeah.
And in this article from the New York Times titled Trump's Threat to North Korea Was Improvised, written by Glenn Thrush and Peter Baker. So he says, quote, the president, people close to him say, believes he has a better feel for Mr. Kim than his advisors do. He thinks of Mr. Kim as someone used to pushing people around, and Mr. Trump thinks he needs to show that he cannot be pushed. So it's all a power play to him.
Yeah, it's a dick measuring contest.
And it's unbelievable because we are talking about countries in reality. Like, we're talking about the world.
Right.
These are essentially organizations.
But guys,
so there's this country and that country. And within country, it's made up of humans.
Yeah, but that's not all.
Yeah.
Later on in the week, this past week that's felt like 1,000 years, Trump said military solutions are now fully in place, locked and loaded, should North Korea act unwisely. Hopefully Kim Jong-un will find another path, he tweeted. Asked about his locked and loaded tweet, he told reporters, he doubled down. This is from the BBC News, by the way. He told reporters, I hope that they, North Korea, are going to fully understand the gravity of what I said, and what I said is what I mean. Those words are very, very easy to understand.
This is like, it's, I don't think he understands it. This is not a board game.
Yeah. Also, wait, hold on. He added,
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I just, oh God, he's just like a rambling old man, if he, Kim Jong-un, utters one threat in the form of an overt threat, which, by the way, he has been uttering for years and his family has been uttering for years, or if he does anything with respect to Guam or any place else that's an American territory or an American ally, he will truly regret it, and he will regret it fast.
That's just poor. That's just poor grammar.
Also, honestly,
that's a run-on sentence.
This is the one compliment I'm going to give him. His breath support, probably incredible. Right. Those sentences have no periods.
He's got it.
Oh, yeah, but you know he did that. What's the thing? Where's the repeating? And by the way, he's been uttering it for years. And his family's been uttering it for years. Because he does that like weird, like dramatic pause. Things. He repeats shit.
He did it in Charlottesville.
Yeah.
On so many sides.
Because apparently that's emphasis when you repeat things.
And it's like, no.
But
But
also when saying that, it might as well be, it's like that video with Celine Dion saying, this song is dedicated to the parents and the children of the world. Girl, that's everybody. So when he's saying,
but I do love Celine.
Yes, I love her.
Let's not compare.
She's holy. We like her. Anything with respect to Guam or any place else that's an American territory, American ally, it's like, so everyone, you want to make sure that they don't hurt anyone, but like you kind of singled out all of your people that you represent. And Guam, you know, Guam is actually having to advertise like how to react to like a nuclear
attack. Hawaii too has been
like, okay, well, here's what you got to do. Like, people have to brace for this now.
Also, I don't
locked and loaded.
Locked.
Are you kidding me?
So this is a diehard bitch.
I feel like he did this to in his Paris Accords. He did this to Pittsburgh. He was I was elected by the people of Pittsburgh, and Pittsburgh's like, what? And I feel like he's doing it again with Guam. He's like, if they do anything in respect of Guam, I mean, or American territories, because I'm the president and I'm supposed to, you know, talk about everything.
Well, I think
what?
The thing too is, so this is an AP News article written by Matthew Pennington, and it says, beyond the bluster, U.S. North Korea in regular contact. So the United States and North Korea have this thing called the New York Channel, and it's a channel that they use to communicate. And in this article, they talk about how the Obama administration had sort of stopped using it because new sanctions were placed on North Korea and North Korea broke off their communications. But since then, they have had regular contact with North Korea through this channel. And in the article, it says the contacts are occurring regularly between Joseph Yun, the U.S. envoy for North Korea policy, and Park Song-il, a senior North Korean diplomat at the country's U.N. mission, according to U.S. officials and others briefed on the process. So there are talks happening between North Korea and the United States that are being destroyed because you have two madmen as the leaders of these countries blustering and saber-rattling. I just think that, you know, Trump is so inept at his job that he is ruining the true diplomat. If he just shut his mouth, there are people there that can find a diplomatic solution. You know, I mean, there have been Republican presidents in the past that have not utterly destroyed this country. It's possible to do it. It's possible.
Less tweeting, dear DT.
Yeah.
Less tweeting.
So there was that. And then I thought this was kind of an interesting article. It's called The Last Time the U.S. Was on the Brink of War with North Korea. It's by Amanda Erickson. And it's from The Washington Post. And it talks about the Clinton administration in 1994. They had sort of a run-in with North Korea because they were preparing to remove nuclear fuel rods from a research reactor in Yongbyon. And those rods contained 5 or 6 bombs worth of weapons-grade plutonium. Ashton B. Carter, who was the Assistant Secretary to Defense, said that we felt that this would bring a potentially hostile nation to the United States across the nuclear finish line, and that wasn't acceptable to us. So Bill Clinton was considering going into armed conflict with North Korea, and then, this is insane, as Clinton was mulling someone came into the Oval Office, this is from the article, and told those gathered that former president and podcast favorite, President Jimmy Carter, was on the phone. Carter was in Pyongyang meeting with North Korea's aging leader, Kim Il-sung, as a private citizen, and he had, without authorization or authority, negotiated something of a peace deal. So
I want to believe that he brought his peanuts from his farm with him. He's like, hey.
I'm sure he did. He's a very thoughtful guy.
He's like, Kim Il-sung, this is my Jimmy Carter impression. I'm trying to work at it. Do y'all want a peanut?
It's getting better.
Is it getting better?
Is that the word we use? Okay, cool.
Well, it's not getting worse.
So, also, but in this it says, at the time, defenders of the deal argued that it had averted a devastating war, but Congress hated it, and George W. Bush took a highly skeptical view of the deal. By 2002, the framework was declared a failure. So even this, you know, God bless Jimmy Carter for trying to do it a peaceful way, didn't work. So this is a complicated issue. I just think that if you do have this Open New York channel, use it. Don't go on Twitter and say that you're locked and loaded like you're in an '80s movie.
Ever. Don't ever say things like that.
Also,
or type or whatever.
And lastly, this is from the St. Louis Dispatch, but stepped up rhetoric on North Korea wiped $1 trillion off of world stocks. So there's a real world problem too.
There's a real world fun fact.
Anyway.
Emily, you know what it's time for?
Oh, God.
Russia!
I wrote it like that because it kind of looks, it's like you're screaming at Russia.
It is, that is me screaming to our listeners. It's spelled Russia with lots of A's at the end and then H's.
Russia.
So imagine my face right now as I look at it.
So the big news earlier in the week was, and I'm referencing a Washington Post article right now, is that FBI conducted a pre-dawn raid of former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort's home. So FBI agents raided the Alexandria home of President Trump's former campaign chairman late last month, using a search warrant to seize documents and other materials, according to people familiar with the special counsel investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 election. Manafort has been voluntarily producing documents to congressional committees investigating Russia's interference in the election. The search warrant indicates investigators may have argued to a federal judge that they had reason to believe Manafort could not be trusted to turn over all records in response to a grand jury subpoena. So I find it interesting that he was pretty forthcoming with information at first, but there was enough doubt that they said, "Nah, we got to go to his place." And then he's like, "Okay, great, come on in," because he kind of had to.
Yeah, well, but I mean, a pre-dawn raid isn't like a come on in thing.
No, no, no. Well, I mean, he has to open the door, probably in his bathrobe, and he's like, "Okay, well."
Well, there's nothing you can do about it. I mean, you should, if you guys get a chance, you should watch Get Me Roger Stone. It's a Netflix documentary. Mm-hmm. And Roger Stone, who's like the worst person that's ever lived, he's like him and Jake Paul. he's a political operative, and he's worked with Paul Manafort for years. And these guys are like the guys that started the lobbying industry. They're not good men. Mm-hmm. Paul Manafort is not a good man.
This is really just to say that like the investigation is moving forward. So, Emily, you might be getting your wish. We might get to a conclusion.
Yeah, can we just...
If we're getting the information,
information
that we need.
Let's look at it. Let's investigate it. Let's do it.
I don't understand. This is... obviously, I wish that our president wasn't a Russian spy, but...
Me too.
But this is like a Tom Clancy novel. I don't understand how you're not intrigued by this. The palace intrigue.
It's not that I'm not intrigued. It's just like,
It is moving at a snail's pace. I will say that.
Go.
But it's not. Watergate took 2 years.
I know. Mm-hmm. That's why. We're that's six the other reason. I'm like, okay, if that's the precedent. With
also, if it wasn't for the fact that it seems like for every little bit of information we get about Russia,
it just
there's like
more
700,000 other things that keep happening. And so it's like, man, you just stop the pain at some point. So if we could get him out of office because of that.
And then, Emily, do you want to take this one? Do you want to read anything in Russia?
Sure.
This category?
Trump. Oh, God. Okay, so this article is from Politico, and it's titled "Trump Thanks Putin for Expelling U.S. Diplomats and Infuriating State Department." Do we need to read any more?
Well,
like, I'm totally kidding.
Do you want to read the quote?
Sure. But yes, I'll read the quote. I'm sorry. President Donald Trump on Thursday thanked Russian president, VP for expelling American diplomats in Russia on the grounds that, quote, "we're going to save a lot of money," prompting dismay among many of the rank and file at the State Department. And then, keep reading. Trump goes on to say, quote unquote, "this is our current president, everybody. Quote, I want to thank him because we're trying to cut down our payroll as far as I'm concerned. And I'm very thankful that he let go of a large number of people now because we have a smaller payroll," Trump told reporters at where?
His golf club in Bedminster,
New
Jersey.
17-day vacation.
Oh, God. So.
Wait, there's more.
There's more. Another quote from DT.
This is the same quote.
There's no, an extenuation of DT, not Putin or someone else in the story.
I apologize.
There's no real reason for them to go back, he added. I greatly appreciate the fact that we've been able to cut our payroll of the United States. We're going to save a lot of money.
And then the next day, they said that Trump was being sarcastic. He was being sarcastic, White House press secretary and worst person ever in second place.
Huckabee
Sanders said.
I can't stand
her. Here's the thing about sarcasm. President Trump is that you can't say it to reporters.
Also,
that's clearly not sarcasm. But like,
I watched the video. It's not fucking sarcasm.
No, it's not.
As the president, you are. That's not your job.
Yeah,
to be funny. We have so many comedians that are much better.
Well,
than
I think
you.
I think the president, any president, can be funny because Obama was very funny.
But
you got to pick and choose
your
and
moments.
When, yeah, and
when we're talking about Russia, there is never a moment.
Well, this is
you
what
are
I
currently under investigation about Russia. There is no moments for sarcasm or humor in this.
This is what I was talking about
you,
before too,
Donald
though.
Trump.
It's like it's,
leave that
it's,
to us.
I know. Well, it's like you know, it's the same thing with Jared. Jay Kush.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, is he tricking us with his forgetting to mention 100 foreign contacts on his F-86 form, or is he an idiot? Is he an idiot? So is Donald Trump, does Donald Trump think that he can, think that being sarcastic is fine when he's talking about a potentially foreign crisis?
And
or is he an idiot?
And it's also...
He's an idiot.
It's that, like, but it's also a demonstration of a complete lack of respect for...
The diplomats?
For the country, for the Constitution, for what you're supposed to be doing. Like,
yeah.
In this role, and in, you know, your role as whatever advisor you're supposed to be, Jay Kush, the part of the process is filling out the form accurately.
Right. I'm just saying, Trump's got to, like, so read, like, the room. You don't make a joke when a bunch of people get kicked out. What are you doing?
Because, I mean, the chain of events here, though, is that Putin was upset about the sanctions put on Moscow. And so he said, okay, fine, I'm sending your diplomats back. So Trump is essentially, and Trump didn't want to sign it, but he had to because it was veto proof. So it's almost like a ha ha.
You're talking about the bill that was passed that prevents him from removing sanctions. Yeah.
Right. And so he it's really just a reaction. And the other thing I want to talk about is the fact that his people always the next day have to say, oh yeah, he was being sarcastic, or oh yeah, he didn't mean that. Today they even said, we're recording this on Sunday. Their people came out and said, oh, of course he means that the violence came from the white nationalists, they won't say Nazis, but they'll say, oh yeah, the terrorists. So everyone always has to cover his tracks, but he doesn't mean the shit that they're saying.
Yeah.
So, he means what he's saying.
Yes.
Yeah.
So don't cover up for it anymore.
He's a nightmare person. Let's move on.
Yeah.
The Mad King. I titled this one for all my GOT fans. Emily doesn't watch Game of Thrones. She's like one of the 10 people. Okay, so a memo went out to the National Security Council, and it's insane. So foreignpolicy.com got a hold of this memo, and they Jenna Winter and Elias Grohl wrote something that says, wrote an article that says, here's the memo that blew up the NSC. And it's a 7-page document, which eventually landed on the president's desk, and it precipitated a crisis that led to the departure of several high-level NSC officials tied to former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, the author of the memo, Rich Higgins, who was in the strategic planning office at the NSC, was among those recently pushed out. This is from the article. There's a lot of really problematic language in this, and it sort of, you know, paints Trump as the victim, of course. Of the quote-unquote deep state. And it says, while opposition to President Trump... Oh, my God.
That was a fidget spinner.
Sorry, I dropped my
fidget. Sorry, we
it's
dropped
not even
our
yours,
fidget
it's mine.
Spinner. While we're talking about a national security crisis, we
priority.
Dropped
I didn't read the
fidget
room. I didn't read
spinner.
The room.
Yep.
I apologize, and mean it. It is not sarcasm.
All right, so this
carry
is,
on.
This is from the memo. While opposition to President Trump manifests itself through political warfare memes centered on cultural Marxist narratives, this hardly means the opposition is limited to Marxists as conventionally understood. And then it goes on. Having become the dominant cultural meme, some benefit from it while others are captured by it, including deep state actors, globalists, bankers, Islamists, and establishment Republicans. So just to be clear, bankers means Jews. That's what that means. And it is code word. And it is fucked up. Globalists means liberals and progressives. I want to remove the paint, the veneer from this bullshit that this Rich Higgins, you know, they write stuff like this and then they're shocked that there are people dressed up as Nazis in Virginia. It is ridiculous. It is anti-Semitism coded in false bullshit. And so they wrote this, and now H.R. McMaster is, you know, actively at war with people that are part of Flynn's posse. I mean, this is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. It's ridiculous.
You're right. Tom Clancy couldn't write a better novel.
No.
About this.
We're getting into Dan Brown territory.
Oh, ooh.
Yeah.
If I find out the Catholic Church is behind it, I don't know what to do.
No, because the Pope also hates the president.
Yeah, it's definitely...
The literal Pope hates the president.
And while the Pope hates the president
such
hates...
such a good picture of them together.
The president hates climate change.
Which is the planet on which we live, to be clear.
So an article from The Guardian by Bill McKibben, the Trump administration's solution to climate change... Ban the term.
The term. Let's talk about language, DT. If we're going to talk about language, we need to start with yours.
Yeah.
Like,
we are much
this
sassier
is not...
than usual. Today we've come out a little sassy.
Yes. We're much nicer people in person. Give us a hug.
We are nice people.
At birthday party.
All the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We danced ourselves clean and now we're.
Yeah. You know,
that was the name of the event, everybody.
I definitely made a restaurant clap for Barack Obama last night.
And I've never been more proud.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry
to
that ramen joint.
that you made their night.
All right. So from the article, in a bold new strategy unveiled on Monday in The Guardian, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, guardians of the planet's richest farmlands, has decided to combat the threat of global warming by forbidding the use of the words. Under guidance from the agency's director of soil health, Bianca Mibas-Clune, a list of phrases to be avoided includes climate change and climate change adaption to be replaced
adaptation.
By to be replaced by weather extremes and resilience to weather extremes. Also blacklisted is the scary.
I'm really sorry to interrupt, but this is not productive talking about language. Like
right.
It's like, okay, cool. Like, I'm down. Like, if you don't want to make climate change your priority and whatever, and you don't fully believe in the science and you're skeptical, I disagree with you. But everybody is entitled to their own opinion. But arguing about the language, mm-hmm. It's like, no. Okay, if you're super passionate about coal, or I don't know what people that are on that side of the fence are passionate about, whatever it is, like, tell me how you're addressing climate change, if you're addressing it at all, or if you're not, and then other people can adjust accordingly, and we can reinvest our time and efforts to combat it, like many of the mayors who have come together to create that group of mayors that are actively working on it on a local level. Okay, fine. But this is not accomplishing anything. This is like wasting time about.
Well, it's like it's also
a
like
word.
A wink that they know. Mm-hmm. It's like, we know that climate change is a thing, but we're gonna fuck you over.
Yeah,
it
sounds like lazy and procrastination. That like, well, we don't have to deal with it because you know it's only a small part of a temperature.
Yeah,
like, no,
I'll never understand this weird war with climate change. You know, they want to say like, oh, it's this left conspiracy that they came. I'm like, no, it's a thing that's happening. It's outside. Just look, you know, like, the world's changing around you, and I don't know why you're fighting it unless
it's because it's coal, well,
money,
and oil.
Yeah.
It goes back to money, which is so exciting because we're about to have a great interview talking about money, but not yet. But I just can't wait to get to it.
Yeah, Kat Taylor of Beneficial State Bank.
Yeah,
so
we'll get there.
We'll get there in a second. Let's do
a few more things.
Let's just go to the section of hope, because we've talked about a lot of nasty things.
Yeah, let's do.
And there is some hope on the horizon. And that comes in the form of a judge has said an October 18th argument in the Trump foreign emolument suit. So Trump never really relinquished his businesses to his sons. There's no paperwork that says he has done that. He has just said that, which would put him in direct violation of the Foreign Emoluments Clause, which is a clause in the Constitution of the United States. It states that no head of state will accept foreign pay. And if you're staying at his hotel, you're violating it. So this is a Politico article written by Josh Gerstein, and he wrote that a lawsuit contending that President Donald Trump's business dealings with and in foreign countries violate the Constitution is set to get a public airing in October in a New York federal courtroom. The suite is one of about half a dozen lawsuits targeting income Trump derives from foreign sources. One of those additional cases is pending before Daniels. The other are before federal courts in Washington, D.C., Greenbelt, Maryland, and West Palm Beach, Florida. So that's four federal courts that are investigating the Emoluments Clause on top of his Russia stuff, on top of also the sexual assault stuff.
I'm nodding.
On top of what else? His repeated executive orders that don't work.
Yeah. Poor grammar.
I don't know.
Inability to respect the position.
Yeah. And then lastly, does anyone want to take this last bit of hope?
I'll take it. Yes. So in this article from ShareBlue.com, red state victory. Iowa Democrat wins special election in a district that Trump won by 21 points. So at the state and local level, Republicans have found themselves struggling to remain competitive in special elections as the backlash against Donald Trump continues to grow. Phil Miller, a local large animal veterinarian and Democratic candidate, defeated GOP candidate Travis Harris in a special election for Iowa's 82nd House District. Miller took 54% of the vote to Harris's 44. In the 14th special election, it is the 14th special election that Democrats have won since Trump's election. This district specifically was heavily rural and close to the Illinois border, and was already held by Democrats, but the previous representative, Kurt Hansen, died in June, and he had benefited from the incumbency. And although the district contains relatively even numbers of registered Democrats and Republicans, it voted for Trump by a 21-point margin. So the Republican was a heavy favorite to win, but here we are.
Democrats today are winning.
What's happening?
So John Ossoff, you know, maybe not, but Democrats in the majority are winning.
Yes. People showed up in the flyover states.
And yeah.
Cool.
And just to, before we're going to do one last little bit here, we posted on Facebook earlier this week our unofficial guide to getting involved. Yeah.
Just for James.
Thank you. So in case you've missed a couple episodes, or you listened to them, but you missed a few little key helpful hints, we have a nice little breakdown for you. Just check out our Facebook page. I think we also put it up on Instagram.
Yep.
So just give it a look and get involved, because as we're seeing, a little bit counts. And so these special elections, they will make a huge difference, especially coming into 2018.
Yeah.
And I'm so excited about this next guest we're going to have on, because one of the things that connects all of the different areas we're talking about getting involved is money. Whether we like it or not, it's involved in every system, generation, area of the world, et cetera, et cetera. And so super excited for you guys to listen to Kat Taylor.
And just before we go, I just wanted to do a quick mention. One of my professors passed away this morning, and she was a voice professor at the University of Michigan, and she touched a lot of lives, and she was a very active, progressive, wonderful human being. And she taught us not only to be artists, but also to be humans and to always care. And she was always ready to talk about social things that were happening around the country and getting involved. And so I just wanted to dedicate this episode to Annette. We love you so much, and may you rest in peace. Hey guys, do you know what I'm wearing right now?
What you wearing, Nick?
I am wearing Mack Weldon sweats.
What?
Get out.
Mack Weldon sweatpants. Mack Weldon is a premium men's essentials brand that believes in smart design and premium fabrics. I love these sweatpants. They're amazing. I'm very comfortable.
So. You know, I love my sweatpants.
Yeah
you got and I pair. Also got a pair of boxers, like a cash laying around the house.
Hannah got a pair of sweatpants. I got her pair. So now we're matching.
Right.
So it means
socks. The socks are nice.
Yeah. So they have like underwear, socks, shirts, undershirts, hoodies. I have this really comfortable hoodie that I got. It's nice and gray. When it's cold out here in California, anytime after 6 p.m., I'm still cozy. I love that thing.
Yeah. I wore these sweatpants that I'm currently wearing to a party. Nobody noticed. It was amazing.
You
and people notice me at parties. I don't want to brag.
All right.
I make a bit of a scene, but people didn't know that I was wearing sweatpants.
And the scene is like them escorting him out because, you know, just his personality. Mm-hmm. But the clothes,
because I'm loud,
look awesome.
The clothes also look great. I looked great getting ushered
how
out.
How easy was ordering?
Super easy.
Super easy, yes.
And so if you do order, so you go to MackWeldon.com and you can get 20% off using the promo code REBEL. Or yes. Rebel.
And if you...
R-E-B-E-L.
R-E-B-E-L. And they want you to be comfortable. So if you don't like the first pair, you can keep it and they will still refund you. No questions.
Yeah.
This is like Mack Weldon. They're great. They're on your side and the clothes are amazing.
Yeah. Mack Weldon is truly a gift to
also,
all of us.
Also, they eliminate... truly, because they eliminate your odor at the parties.
Oh, that's true. They're antimicrobial. All right. I've actually never been escorted out of a party. It was a quiet get-together, and I looked great. And at one point, I was like, does anyone notice that I have sweatpants on? And they were like, no. Where are those from? And I was like, Mack Weldon. And then I turned around, and I've got a little back pocket, and people were like, you got a back pocket on sweatpants? And I was like, yeah, you can literally wear them anywhere. You can wear them anywhere. I sounded like Chris Traeger. You can literally wear them anywhere. Parks and Rec's a great show. MackWeldon.com. 20% off using the promo code REBEL or REBEL, R-E-B-E-L. And that's great. We got a dope interview, so.
Stick around. So we're back, everybody. Welcome back to the second half of our podcast. We're really excited to introduce this week's guest to talk about a topic we haven't really touched on yet.
Not yet.
So we're going to welcome Kat Taylor, who's the co-CEO and co-founder of Beneficial State Bank. Hi, Kat.
Hi. It's so nice to be here. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about banking.
Yes. Absolutely.
Thank you for teaching us.
Absolutely. And so, I mean, I think we should just jump in with how does one go about founding a bank?
It's not the usual thing that one does, and it actually is getting harder and harder to do. But we had a hunch that something was not quite right with the banking system. The banking system should be a quasi-public system, one in which we both recognize and take our agency, but also accept our accountability, that it's a system with enormous public prerogatives, starting with federal deposit insurance, which we all pay into as banks, but it really allows depositors to put up to $250,000 in risk-free to any bank. And it represents to us in a metaphorical way the original and most powerful form of crowdfunding. Most people know crowdfunding through Indiegogo or Kickstarter or something like that, where they pool their funds together because they want to see something happen. Well, that's in essence what banking should be, but it has become something very far afield from that.
Yes, true.
to say the least.
When did it start? Was it in response to something, or did you just get into the game because it was already something that you just always thought was wrong, or was there an inciting incident? Or
Right. So it was a hunch that grew over time, and we were alerted to the importance of the banking system and economic access and opportunity in general from the civil rights movement. I was born in 1958. My life has been marked by the incredible crusade to overcome this country's legacy of slavery, Jim Crow, and now mass incarceration. And I was waiting to see how I could be of service in that movement. The civil rights leadership identified that the legal and political rights would not come to full fruition if there weren't economic opportunity and access to accompany them. And that spawned the launching of some legendary banks, notably South Shore Bank in Chicago, Self Help Credit Union in North Carolina, and even in a sense, the global movement of banks that are socially and environmentally responsible, like the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh. I grew up and was in college and graduate school during that time, and I realized that I could bring my opportunities set to something like financial access. It took many decades to realize the opportunity because you have to have capital, you have to be organized, you have to have regulatory compliant directors, et cetera, to start a bank. But what triggered that was that my husband, Tom Steyer, and I were pretty sure that John Kerry had won the election in 2004.
I remain somewhat
convinced that he did. But anyway, other media told us differently the next morning, and we thought, wow, maybe it's time to start a bank. So we were in a position to do that at that time and started a bank to be a pioneering firm in the banking movement where we could realize the insights of an actor in the system and figure out what actually was wrong. We had a hunch something was wrong, but we weren't quite certain what was wrong. And then maybe we could also build a bank that could influence the system to move to better outcomes for everybody.
Sure. So specifically, what were some of those things you learned in the list of what's wrong that you then implemented in new ways at Beneficial State Bank?
So somehow the banking system, which is enormously powerful because it has that insurance, which allows us all in the banking system to collect deposits both relatively readily and risk-free, which means they're low cost. Our cost of funds at our bank is about 50 basis points right now. That's half of a percent. If you go to raise capital in any other setting, it's going likely to be much, much more expensive than that. So it's a little bit like rocket fuel. Deposits are low-cost rocket fuel. On top of that, we're allowed to leverage our equity capital 10 to 1. So you might think, oh, let's not go to the bother of being a bank. Let's just be a loan fund. Let's collect money and loan it out to constructive activities for the planet, the people, and everyone else. But you're likely only going to be able to loan on a one-to-one basis. You collect a dollar, you lend a dollar. Maybe you can apply some debt, but it's not going to come to 10 times leverage, which is what our bank, the most conservatively capitalized bank, in one of the most conservatively capitalized banks in the system, is allowed to do. So roughly speaking, this is not technically accurate, but for every $1 of equity capital we put into the bank, we're allowed to raise $9 of deposits. That equates to us making a $10 loan with just $1 of equity.
Wow.
The power comes from the insurance, the leverage. It's a recycling model. So when we lend money out, it comes back and then we get to lend it again. That means the impact accumulates over time. We don't just do something once. We keep doing it over and over and over again. And it's very disciplined. We have 25 exams, internal and external, a year. So we know exactly where the money's going and we can find out what it's doing if we work in earnest to build better metrics. So this very powerful system, which amasses about $12 trillion of deposits in the American economy alone, that's bigger than most any other industry you can think of, should be, in our view, community, state, and nation building, building the world we actually want to live in. And it's very powerful and is capable of doing that. But somehow it's come to these times where it's dragging behind it a train of misery. So it's doing a lot of good things in a very powerful way, but this train of misery, I'll just narrate a few of the cars on the train of misery.
Yes, yes, please.
Yes.
And the train of misery is what has to stop. We need to cut it off. First car, almost 5 million homes were lost in the foreclosure crisis of the Great Recession. Those homes, you may hear that the real culprit was the mortgage brokerage industry, or even the GSEs, the government service agencies, entities that are quasi-public-private entities that buy mortgages from the banks to recycle capital. But in between stood the banks. So the pipeline of mortgage delivery really was the banks. And this is important right now because we're being fed some fake news that the biggest banks had no culpability in the Great Recession, which was driven by the housing bubble bursting. I believe that that's nonsense. I believe that if we believe that, we're going to allow some terrible things to happen, like deregulation of the biggest banks. Mm. In any event, those nearly 5 million foreclosures on homes, and remember, homes are the most likely way that most households in America are going to build wealth. We're not going to do it likely through a big stock portfolio. We're going to do it through our homes. So when those 4 million homes were transferred in foreclosure, they went from the lowest resource households to the highest resource households, meaning that houses didn't, but the wealth shifted.
Sure.
So it exacerbated our wealth disparity, which is an even worse phenomenon than our income disparity. Secondly, everything in the banking system that has been punishing like that has disproportionately affected communities of color. The statistics are shocking and vetted, and it almost looks like a strategy that also needs to stop. One third of bank tellers are on some form of public assistance. And remember, these are private, I mean, they're publicly traded, but these are privately held, meaning the owners of these banks are individuals, not the government.
Sure.
And so that represents a shocking shift of a private cost to a public resource. And they're among the most profitable corporations in the world. So why they should not be able to pay one third of their employees enough to sustain themselves needs to be asked. Coal industry. Nothing I'm saying I mean in any disrespect to coal miners or coal communities, but the coal industry needs to be over. It is technically bankrupt in spite of this administration's desires to prop it up by opening up public lands for exploration of coal and development of coal. Most of the big coal companies went bankrupt. They shifted their pension liabilities to subsidiaries that landed on the U.S. government in bankruptcy. So the public is now paying the pension responsibilities of many of the big coal companies, and they're eking out the last rents of profitability from coal. And we know that coal is one of the biggest accelerators of not only climate change, but those coal mining jobs were very well paying and created coal economies and coal cultures, but coal miners have very short life expectancies. We need to do better by coal miners and coal economies and get them into the renewable, advanced energy economy as quickly as possible. Not an easy thing to do. It's our responsibility to do it, but we should not be propping up the coal industry. And the biggest banks in the banking industry devoted $250 billion of finance to the coal industry just in the last 10 years.
Wow. When I hear numbers like that, I don't even understand what it means. I'm like, that is how much money? It's very, conceptually, it's like unbelievable to think of. It's beyond belief.
But also to pour them. Go ahead. No.
Sorry, James. Here's a good level setting for numbers. The last car on the train of misery is that approximately $350 billion, with a B, of penalties for abusing consumers have been paid by the biggest banks in the last, I think it's only 5 years, since it's largely as a result of the CFPB and other entities imposing them. And that sounds like a really huge number, and it is a really huge number, but it's not a big enough number in such a massive industry to change practice.
Wow.
Because these are such lucrative business lines serving consumers, particularly credit cards and things like that, that you can afford to pay those penalties and still be making a lot of money. One of the biggest banks in the industry, over $2 trillion in assets, had a $4 billion capital account error ride their balance sheet without their audit committee on the board or their outside auditors noticing it for a year. But in truth, $4 billion to a $2 trillion company is like change you could lose in your car.
Sure.
So this is a law of very big numbers, that it takes a lot to shift such a massive system.
Wow. And when you were saying earlier how, you've got to vote with your money at the bottom line at the end of the day. And so, when you say something like that, where $4 billion doesn't really mean anything to these companies, how can we impact, how can we make an impact on them so that they recognize we're upset with the way they're handling our money, where the money's going to? What can we do about that?
Yeah. So this is my opinion, Kat Taylor, but there's a negative network effect happening in banking that's quite akin to the negative network effect in voting. Here's how it works in voting. Normally, in an electoral process, the middle of the bell curve would win the election. And that's what most electeds and candidates do, is they try to appease the middle of the bell curve. So a much bigger volume of people in the center. But when you start to believe that your vote is too small to matter and you defect, it's the opposite of a network effect. The network effect of the internet, the phone system, etc., is that every member who joins increases the value of the existing membership. A negative network effect is every member who defects worries the existing membership that their vote doesn't matter either, and so they defect. Pretty soon, when the middle of the bell curve all defects, election outcomes are determined by the tails on either side. In our national political system, it's the far left and the far right, and you see elections on the national level decided by a paltry number of votes, and you see the conversation around the vote being dominated by shrill and very intense voices. Same thing is happening in banking.
Wow. And I remember when I heard Kat speak earlier this year, and I think that those parallels between different industries is exactly why we are hosting this podcast, is changing how we think about the political landscape so that we understand where we slot in and slot out of exactly what you're talking about with that bell curve. So what are some of the options, you know, to defect, you know, the current system that people can look into, either locally? You're based in San Francisco. I know your bank is in, I believe, 3 states, you know, but also nationwide. What are some options for people to dig into?
Sure. So in the banking system, we've been led to believe also that our small dollar accounts don't matter, that they won't move anybody. And so when none of us do anything with our small dollar accounts, then truly nothing happens. And we get a system that has become increasingly concentrated, that has massive financial incumbents. And also psychologically, I think we get a mindset of this is the way it's always been done, thus it shall always be. Well, we're, if nothing else in life right now on this planet, we can't accept this is how it's always been done, thus it shall always be.
Exactly.
So we have to awaken the agency of depositors to realize that individually they're right, they don't matter, but collectively they do. So to be sort of cliched, but this is the fight of people power over the power of financial incumbents or capital. So capital's been whooping on labor for a long time, but we forget that labor is people. It's not an abstract concept. It's us. It's people. So we have to find a way to awaken the agency, meaning the awareness even that you have the power of choice in your banking decision. And then we have to awaken the accountability, because if you're not attendant to where your money sleeps at night, likely it's working against you. I mean, I can say that as a blanket statement, because 99% of us are in the 99%, and the current banking system is really not serving our values. And if you're not aware of where you're banking, you probably have made the sort of unconscious choice of just going with one of the biggest banks. The biggest banks control super majority of the bank assets. And if you're in any of the top 7 or 10 or even 15 money center banks, I guarantee you, by their size alone, they are involved in something that you would just hate, either fossil fuel development or Dakota Access Pipeline or private prisons or consumer abuse. And I'm sorry to say it this way, because I actually love the people who work at these big banks. I'm not out to vilify the people of these banks.
Sure.
It's that the capital markets and the decision makers that the capital markets choose tend to favor a negative natural selection of who will do the most extreme thing to meet the demands of the capital markets, which is to have ever-increasing stock prices on a quarterly basis. So if we simply get out of the big banks, we're probably doing a lot better. Mm. I'm not suggesting that everybody in a big bank rush to our bank, which is a very tiny bank. We are a tiny but mighty bank. We are approaching $1 billion in assets. That's 1 and a B, not 2 and a T. There's so many zeros between us and that, it's ridiculous. But in a sort of David and Goliath way, we tried to create a bank that was super aligned in the public interest, could operate in the system as a real actor and understand deeply what's going on, and then broadcast to depositors and other stakeholders of the banking system. The stakeholders of the banking system are broad. They're depositors, transactors, borrowers, communities, the planet, the public, etc. And tell them what they need to do in order to take the banking system back. They shouldn't all move to a tiny bank like ours. It only serves 3 states. But they should become aware of the networks of banks that represent potentially a much better choice for where they let their money sleep at night.
Because I know credit unions are also options. I hear a lot of people say, take your money out of Chase, go to your local mom and pop credit union, like they're working for you. So what are credit unions? Beneficial State Bank, it's not a credit union, right?
No, but it's a great connector, because we're the closest thing to a credit union that a bank could be.
Okay.
So credit unions are owned by their members. And in this country, we largely granted credit union charters the ability to start a member-based financial deposit-taking institution on either the basis of geography or occupation. So you might, Patelco is what's the successor to all the Ma Bell, the telephone companies. All the employees of those telephone companies were under deregulation, were put together in Pacific Telesis or whatever the phone companies were, and they were allowed to have occupationally derived credit unions. Same with firefighters, same a lot of other occupations. Or it could be based on a geography, like when we started the bank, we started it in Oakland. We could have applied for an Oakland credit union charter, I think. I don't know as much as I should about it. We couldn't pursue it because we actually lived in San Francisco at the time, and we didn't want to start a credit union we couldn't belong to. But being member-owned gives those institutions potentially much better alignment and accountability, because their members can say to them, no, we don't want to do that. This is basically our institution. Beneficial State Bank, it has a unique ownership structure where 100% of our economic rights are owned by a public charity foundation of the same name, Beneficial State Foundation. And that foundation is governed permanently in the public interest. A majority of its board, which appoints its CEO, have to be appointed by three public charities: Bridge Housing, which represents everyone's right to safe and affordable housing; East Bay College Fund, which has transitioned out, but will get another member in their place, but they represented everybody's right to higher education; and the Tides Foundation, a progressive grant-making organization that represents our need for community-based connection and community building. Those entities appoint the majority of the board, so it can never be a board that's serving a private shareholder. No individual can control it. Mm-hmm. We don't even have a private shareholder. At the end of the day, and if any profits are distributed from the bank to the foundation, which is the only entity that can get the profits, its bylaws mandate that it has to reinvest those profits into the low-income communities that we serve and the environment upon which we all depend. So I mentioned as a metaphor that banking to us is like crowdfunding. In the beginning, we pool our deposits to finance the world we actually want to live in. And at the far end of the process, when we reinvest our profits, we're reinvesting it back into the world that we're financing to strengthen it. That's as close to a credit union as I can get in a bank setting. And just a sidebar, banks have been very antithetical to credit unions because from an American tax point of view, America taxes banks twice because they tax the bank for the earnings that it makes, and then they tax the shareholder for the dividends that it gets. In the credit union setting, it doesn't tax the credit union. It taxes the members who own the credit union. So it's single taxation versus double taxation. This is set up an animosity that's decades old, maybe longer. We love credit unions. We love credit unions because of their alignment, and we actually think if banks behave with the alignment that the community development financial institutions have, for instance, where our bank is a CDFI, that's what that stands for, in order to get that status from Treasury, 60% of your loans have to fall into qualified low-income assessment areas. That's what banking should be doing.
Yep.
If they would give us single taxation for that, we'd think that was a good idea too, and I think it would be in the public interest.
Yep. Wow. This is so much information, but it's so exciting to talk to you, because as much as we don't want it to, everything comes back to money. Most of our problems circle back to money, because it's a system the entire world has bought into, versions of money and value, and what is that? And I'm just like, I am so overwhelmed.
Yeah, what is it? I mean, what is it like? Do you have contact with like big banks? I mean, I can't imagine that they're wild about. I mean, you know, guys are
they
doing.
Don't notice us. But what they do notice, and this is our thesis, we're not going to replace the banking system. We're a tiny dust mote in the universe to them. What we're going to do is show the large regional banks who have to steal market share of deposits, equity capital, and talent, human capital, from the big banks. That's the only place they're going to get it, unless they grow it themselves. But we are trying to show them the behaviors that will help them woo over those three constituencies. So we have this lending practice where we insist that 75% of our dollars are in the new economy, fully inclusive, racially and gender just, environmentally restorative. We broadcast exactly who's getting our borrowing dollars, our lending dollars. They have to be change makers producing something that we actually need, like affordable housing or sustainable food, renewable energy, mm-hmm. or they have to be aligned in the public interest like us, like worker cooperatives or B corporations, or they simply have a voice that needs to be in the economy, and we've been excluding it. Women and minority-owned businesses, small business in general, low-income communities, the nonprofit sector. And we make sure that a preponderance of our lending is going to entities like that. The other 25% can't be working against us. We also practice radical transparency. You can find out anything about our bank that you want to know way beyond the banks. The myriad things that banks are supposed to report upon don't include things like this. Like we pay 150% of living wage in all markets, fully benefited. We will not finance fossil fuel. We took the Paris No Coal Pledge. We fight for 15. We're a B corporation, second highest rated in the United States. All these things we're doing, not only so that we show up right, but so that we can show these large regional banks, do some things like this, make some real stands, make commitments, hold yourself accountable to them, tell your stakeholders what you're doing, and you will win these wars. You will win the deposits from those Dakota Access Pipeline protesters who won't stay in those banks that are financing that anymore. You will win the divest invest wars of the big foundations who know where to divest their portfolios from, but they don't know where to invest in. You can get their equity capital. You will win the human talent. We have a summer internship program, fellows, I think they're now called, of young, talented people who are completely mission-driven, never thought they would work for a bank, but they recognize that a bank is a business tool for change. So that's what we're mounting out there, and we're trying to do both and awaken the agency and accountability of banking's main stakeholders and win these market share wars for the regional banks. So I neglected to mention before, but we do host, and it's agnostic. It's not like you have to put your money with us. Nope. Don't do that. It's a move your money banking toolkit that will give you a lot of resources to research where you're banking now, where you might be banking, what you need to think about when you move. It's not that easy to move bank accounts. There's a lot of regulatory stuff that makes it a little bit harder. You also, you know, you don't want to move out of a credit card that you have to one that you don't know if you're going to get. But your banking accounts, checking, saving, your credit card, all that, you can get some good advice on it from this toolkit about how to align your banking with your values.
And this toolkit is available on Beneficial State Bank's website, correct?
It's actually, I'll tell you, www.beneficialstate.com is the bank's website and okay. has a lot of good information. www.beneficialstate.org is the Bank Foundation website. And that's where you can find with / the Impact website that tells you everything I think that we could possibly say about our lending practice and our corporate practices and everything else. And it also hosts on the Beneficial State Foundation website, the Move Your Money Toolkit.
Amazing.
I think it's amazing. It's nice to hear that there's, you know, because, yeah, you hear bank and you hear big bank, and I think there's a lot of fear with that, but you guys are bringing the humanity and transparency that I think that mm-hmm. banking should have always had. So I think it's the show and tell method is fantastic. Like, see, we can do it. You can do it too. Here's how. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's fantastic. Yeah.
And also, it sounds like you're truly thinking about the banking as as an ecosystem. You know, of course, tomorrow Wells Fargo is not going to be like, we're going to do all this too. Because even if they wanted to, it would be impossible. So you're thinking about realistically, to James's question, you know, regional banks can take some steps to address what you're talking about. Individuals can take steps to change. We can all do this research, and that makes a stronger ecosystem. You know, you're you as an institution or bank or foundation, whichever label we want to use, by providing this information, you're investing in the in your people to be smarter investors, to be smarter with their money, to be smarter with their businesses, which I think is huge, because essentially, unless you have parents that teach you how to budget, everybody learns on the fly. Everybody learns when they get their first job, and then they have to pay rent, and then they have to pay health insurance and whatever else they have to pay. That's when they learn about this process. So, you know, very few people are like, I think I'm going to take a personal accounting class and I can afford it. Like, that's not what happens.
So, and it's, money and banking is the invisible piece of your supply chain.
Exactly.
But it's really, really powerful.
Exactly. Yes. So really quick, I mean, before we kind of have to jump, you're also very involved in other things outside of your job. So I would just love to hear, before our time is up with you, you know, what are some of the other, beyond the incredible work the bank you founded does, you know, what are some of your other touch points in the community, either locally, nationally, regionally?
So I should always say this up front, apologies to my incredible husband, Tom Steyer. We co-founded the bank together, and he's chairman of the board. He spends his time at an organization called Next Gen Climate, Next Gen America, and Next Gen California, which is a national advocacy organization acting politically to avert climate disaster, restore broad prosperity, and defend personal liberties. And that is a mission that's about as important as any I can think of right now in these times. They are on something like 330 college campuses. They're practicing true democracy, voter-to-voter engagement. It's not a big sort of money buy of votes. It's a money support of organizing, deep organizing, and it's that people power that they're striving. So I do everything I possibly can to support him in that endeavor, and the bank is very closely linked to NextGen. In spite of the fact that the bank cannot act politically with regard to candidates or things like that, we can take stances on the major issues of the day, and we do all the time, way beyond banking, because we all need to stand up for what's right right now and convince each other to go to turn out and vote for what's right. We even turned the Fresno branch into a polling place last November, so we could add to the precinct infrastructure of Fresno. But that's a very important endeavor, and I mean, daily we see how important that is. This federal administration is just deeply dangerous and problematic. So I'll probably get shot for saying that, but anyway, also, we're, you know, you mentioned the ecosystem. We do try to work at the systems level, and with many heads being better than one. We don't have the answers. We work in large collectives and large coalitions in banking and in energy and climate and politics. We're smarter together than apart. We're better together than apart. So we do a lot of work in the food system as well. The food system, the energy system, and the banking system have deep and comprehensive overlaps. But we need to find people where they're ready, willing, and able to engage. And the food system is one of the best places. I mean, it is. Food is a form of energy. A lot of non-renewable energy is involved in the agricultural system. And a massive amount of injustice results from the way we run the food system right now. Just a massive amount, from the way we treat labor to who has food security to who is most likely going to incur lifelong chronic disease. So those are our, we call them kindergarten terms, but good food, good money, good energy. And we work a lot together to make sure that we can recognize the synergies and the many constituencies who will come together when you start casting the problem a bit wider.
Well, Kat, this has been amazing. You know, the work that you guys are doing, it's really inspiring, and it's great to know that there's good guys, you know, in the banking industry. So once again, for those, especially those on the West Coast in the three states, check out beneficialstatebank.com. And for those of you who want to look at that Move Your Money toolkit, that's beneficialstatebank.com/moveyourmoney. You can take a look at that. So Kat, is there anything else you wanted to share with the audience before we head out of here?
No, it's really an honor to be asked to do this. And, you know, we're learning as we go. So we love getting feedback about, you know, we get really good critical questions and we need them because we're reinventing a lot of stuff in society. And it's really important to do it right with all the stakeholders participating we possibly can recruit. Awesome. So thank you.
Good food, yep. Good money, good energy.
Yeah. I want all those things for everyone.
Yeah. Awesome. Guys, that was Kat Taylor of Beneficial State Bank. You guys, if you guys want to check us out, we are We Rebel at iTunes. Go to whatsacreative.com, search We Rebel, We Rebel Podcast on Twitter, on Instagram, werebelpodcast@gmail.com if you want to leave us a fun note.
And Facebook.
So, hey. Yeah, cool. Awesome.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everyone. See you next week.
What's a Creative Podcast Network?